What is up, fools? Today is October 25th, 2018, and you're listening to the QTR Podcast. As a very quick reminder before we get started, I sound like this is too canned. I'm using too much of a radio voice and more less of my voice that I actually use. So let's just start over. I felt like that was a fucking car commercial, you know? Hello! $2.99 down, 0% for 24 months! All right, what is going on? It's October 25th, 2018. I got the date right. I feel like that's a great start to things today. Couple of things before we get started on this podcast today with one Mr. Kenneth Polcari. The first is just a reminder that I'm not a financial advisor. Furthest thing from it, folks, okay? Very good chance that at some point in the future, I will be cleaning urinals at some corporation that you work for. So keep an eye out for me then, and be nice to me when you see me in the bathroom. Please try not to piss on my head, all right, while I'm working. That's number one. Number two, I do recommend a two-drink minimum for this podcast. I haven't conducted the requisite scientific studies, but I imagine the listening experience is better after two drinks, and it might even get better after that. That's number two. Number three is, honestly, genuinely, sincerely, I want to thank my Patreons. Patreon is a group of my Patreons are a group of people that have decided to make recurring donations to the QTR podcast that help me stay afloat, and they are the engine behind this podcast. So I always want to give them a quick shout out before I get started. I have some new Patreons that I want to shout out: JD Tita, Steve Healy, Garrett Jarvis, Brad Keller. What is up, Michael Lippman? My name is Carl. Colin Turner, Dylan Smith, Jack Burton. There's my homie Steamburger still on there. David Hansen, Leonid Mironov. I appreciate you guys very much. And also I appreciate the guys that have been rolling with me for a minute now. And those who have really been coming through in a big way to help support the podcast. Those of you that don't know, I mean, the goal with the Patreon for me is, if you look on my site, you know, I see I'd like to have 2,500 patrons, whatever the fuck they're called. Anyways, the point is, at some point I would like to get to a point where I take this thing in a bigger direction so that you can get more commentary and just an outlet that is not the financial media, the mainstream financial media, on a more consistent basis. And whether that takes the form of a website or podcast or whatever, all remains to be seen. Folks, I have plans drawn up. It's not in my nature to be mysterious, but I can't tell you, and I can't tell you why. So real quick, I'll just shout out a couple more people that have been my Patreons for a while. Guys like Russ Valenti, who I just saw in Vegas. Great fucking guy. One of my favorites. Chris Bede has been coming through huge. I appreciate that. John Pollard has been around for a while. Patrick Osgood. These guys since August. My friend Christine Richard has been a patron since August. I really appreciate her. You should go read her book, Confidence Game, if you haven't. It's really good. Chris Boas, I really appreciate him, man. He's been around since August as well. Ethan Watkins, Tom Wysocki, Shovel Zombie, Aiden Archer, Bruce Ludman. I don't even know if I've ever said your name before, but you've been down since July, and I appreciate that shit. Okay, so that is it with the sponsorships for now. On the line with me today, who actually just called less than 30 seconds ago, is my main man, Kenneth Polcari, reporting to us live, probably somewhere from the NYSE floor, although he had me, he called from a different number today. So Kenny, just so you know, brother, I spared you all of the sponsorship stuff. I did all of that already just in the last couple of minutes. And yeah. I don't even have your bio in front of me because I'm always generally wholly unprepared to do this podcast. So for those of my listeners that haven't heard you on the podcast before or have no clue who you are, why don't you give us a little background on yourself?
So I am Kenny Polcari. I have been an institutional New York Stock Exchange floor broker for 38 years. Yes, I said it, 38 years, almost four decades. And I started down on the floor in the summer of 1980, and I never left. I fell in love with the place. I fell in love with the business. I fell in love with the action in the auction market. And I've since, you know, over the course of the years, have built my own business and managed the whole New York Stock Exchange division on behalf of Salomon Brothers. And then went back and had my own business after Salomon Brothers got taken over. I started doing television and radio right after the turn of the century in 2001. And I'm a frequent market commentator. commentator. I used to be across a range of outlets, but now I'm a market commentator for CNBC solely. So you might see me, you know, on television up on the set. You might see me on the floor. You might see me across in Asia sometimes if I do Squawk Box Asia or Worldwide Exchange in Europe. So
You're exclusive now to CNBC?
Exclusive to CNBC. I have been for the last 6 years, yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. Well, I thought you just told me that you were on Australian. Were you on Australian CNBC? Is that what it was?
So Sky Australia is, because it's Australia, it's on the other side of the world, it doesn't compete with CNBC, and it's because I had a long time a relationship with them, I continue to do that one because that's not competing with them. But I can't do, you know, Fox or Bloomberg or anyone here in the States, CNN or any of those.
But you can do my podcast, though. That's okay?
I can do your podcast, yeah.
That's great, because I saw you on CNBC yesterday when I was walking past the television at the office, and I was like, first off, you caught a clean shave, man. You look like $1 million, number one. Number two, I was like, man, I can't wait to have that, you know, very prepared looking and just generally, I mean, you looked like somebody who knew what he was talking about. I was like, I can't wait to get him on the podcast tomorrow and have him start cursing and talking about Italian food again. I know deep down inside of you, Kenny, when you're on the air, you just want to grab the camera and be like, you know, and give it a good one. But I know you can't on live television.
Right. You know, you have to. There are certain boundaries you have to respect.
Unfortunately. Well, we don't have any of those boundaries here, which is fantastic. So listen, man, it's awesome to have you back on. I guess we'll just I don't have anything prepared, but obviously one of the things that I wanted to ask about was I wanted to get your take on one of the things I like about you is you're not always beholden to the Fed. So I read your notes every morning, and Kenny puts out an email called Morning Thoughts. And it's one of the more objective things that I've read in terms of your macro perspective, because it always seems like the people that appear on CNBC and the floor traders and people that buy into the finance industry are always just kind of begging the Fed to do whatever they can do to keep markets running up. And I feel like you're much more of an observer, and you're not afraid to kind of ride the bullish wave higher when you know that, you know, the Fed is going to create a bull market. And this is just from reading your notes. But also, too, it doesn't appear to me that you're afraid to identify points where shit could start to hit the fan. And I want your macro take on what's happened over the last week or two.
But I think that's right? I mean, because I think you have to be objective enough to understand what's right and what's wrong with it and where the concerns are, and then how to potentially position it, right? My view is, and my note, just so the listeners understand, is really my perspective of the world as I see it. I write the note every morning at 6 o'clock in the morning directly from my desk at the floor. I kind of take it all into account, what's happened overnight, what's happened in Asia, what's happened in Europe, you know, and how that's going to affect trading for the day. It's a daily letter, so it talks about what I think is going to happen today and where I think you're going to hit resistance and support and all that kind of stuff. And so I try to make it a little bit entertaining, very educational, but a little bit entertaining, and in the end I try to remain objective. And so what I'll tell you, and I think today's note and maybe the notes over the last couple of days of when we talk about the market action and the volatility that's happened, a lot of it is driven, and most of your listeners probably understand this, a lot of it is driven by the technology that exists today, right? The technology is great. It creates all kinds of efficiency, delivery of order flow, execution of order flow, all that. But the speed then at which moves in the market can happen are also then exacerbated. And I think that gets lost sometimes in the conversation. Like yesterday, the market's down 600 points, and, you know, I'm getting phone calls from people going, oh my God, you know, it must be crazy. In fact, it's fairly methodical. It's not panicky at all, because the technology just, you know, it just executes automatically. They've taken the human element out of it. So all that excitement that used to surround it is gone. So I guess on the one hand, you could say that's exciting. But on the other hand, look, the markets are going to back off. The market's going to react to earnings that may disappoint. And those individual companies should absolutely be, you know, punished or rewarded, depending if they miss or beat, right? That's the game. But I think in the broader picture, you have to think about where we're going and what rates are going to do. And we're all, unless you've been living in a cave for the last, you know, 8 years, you realize at some point...
like most financial media. Sorry, well, to just
rates
take
have
a jab
been artificially. rates have been artificially low, and at some point they need to normalize. We need to get back to long-term normal rates, which are, what are they, 4.5% probably is the
Kenny,
long-term average.
Why the fuck is that so hard to understand
I have no idea.
For people.
Because I think people have been so used to, now the last decade almost, we've had near zero interest rates. They've made it very, very easy for people to go out and buy houses and buy cars because interest rates on these loans have been really artificially low. And so people, there's a whole generation almost of people that are used to these artificially low numbers. They don't understand. And the fact is, if the economy is as strong as it is, and I feel fairly good about our economy at the moment, better than I have in a while, is that you would want rates to normalize.
Right.
Because look, when the shit hits the fan again, and they need to once again use monetary policy to help manage us through, they're going to need to cut rates again. And if you never raise them and normalize them, it's going to be difficult to cut them unless you cut them to negative, which you really don't want to do. That's what they did in Europe. That's what they did in parts of Asia. There were actually negative interest rates. You don't really want to go there. And so why people are fighting this fact that rates have to normalize, if you feel good about the economy and you feel good about where we are in terms of the strength of the economy, then you should welcome higher rates. Look, it's going to affect housing. It already is. I don't know about where you live, but where we live in and around the tri-state area, yes, higher rates are kind of a headwind for housing. But okay, look, when I bought my first house, my mortgage rate was 15% in 1985.
Right.
I had a 15% mortgage in 1985. The current mortgage on my house now is 3.75%. So, you know, a 4.5% or a 5% mortgage is nothing for everyone to get worked up about. But they're going to get worked up about it if they had a 2% mortgage, you know, 3 years ago. And now they're going to sell their house and buy a new one. It's going to be 5%. Well, guess what? The cost of doing business.
Yeah, it's – oh, sorry. I didn't know if you were done talking or if you were just taking a breath after that extremely long sentence.
I was doing both, but you feel free to jump in whenever you want.
Dude, no. Listen, all the feedback I've got from when you come on the podcast is like, I'm glad you just let Kenny go for like 20 minutes, a half hour. So you've got the floor here, man. You know, this is listening entertainment for me too, even though I just happen to be hosting it.
Right.
But yeah, listen, man, I think, you know, I find it fascinating that people in the mainstream financial news media, and even now the president, can't seem to fathom exactly what you said, which is, you know, eventually from the rates being low, the shit will hit the fan. I wish you would put it like that on television. I know you can't.
But I can't. I say it in my note, though. I do put it like that in my note.
Yes, you do. And I just don't understand why people, like when I watch Steve Leisman talk about the Fed, or when I watch somebody like Liz Claman talk about, you know, interest rates, or what, even now watching the president talk about, you know, how the Fed is just doing such a terrible job, and every great thing I do, the Fed gets in the way. And it's like, I find it fascinating that he apparently forgets that he campaigned on the issue of we were in a bubble. And that's why I know many people voted for him, because they said, you're right, we are in a bubble. And now that bubble is starting to burst, he's turning around and pointing the finger at an unsuspecting, you know, Jerome Powell, who thought he was going to be on a 4-year cruise vacation as head of the Fed here, and has found out that, you know, he's just been handed a pile of shit from Janet Yellen that he thought was full of gold, and unfortunately is not.
Right. But I think the whole Trump thing, that's part of his spiel, right? I mean, he creates controversy, he does all that. Trump should really, and by rights, he could talk all he wants, he could stamp his feet all he wants, but we all know the Fed is an independent agency, is an independent arm. They cannot be influenced or shouldn't be influenced by what the president at any one point in time wants. Listen, it's all well and good, but it is what it is. The economy is what it is. Would you rather have the Fed hold back on rates and all of a sudden see inflation explode? Because I'm going to tell you something. That's going to be one of the other things you got to worry about. I think inflation is all of a sudden, it's been here, it's been just sub 2%. At some point, there's going to be a reading where it's just going to jump.
Of course.
And it's going to jump big.
And so
in my opinion, as painful as it is, because look, every time he raises rates, whether it's the rate on your credit card goes up, the rate on your interest only loan goes up if you have one, the rate on your HELOC goes up if you have one, the rate on your on your mortgages are going to go up, right? For people that are going to get mortgages. So it's going to create headwinds. I get it. But at some point, it needs to happen. Let's be real. It needs to happen. This free money stuff has got to go away.
Yeah, I agree. And, I just got a text yesterday from a friend of mine, an old friend of mine, who really we only just talk finance once in a while when he has a question. But, he just sent me a message and he was like, is 3% really that big of a deal that the market is, that the market is kind of reacting to it like this? And I said, you need to imagine what a 25 basis point hike does to, trillions of dollars in outstanding debt. I mean, it's not just, everybody kind of looks at it as like, oh, well, my mortgage goes up $50 or my car payment. It's like that Ray Dalio video where he says you have to look at the economic machine as a series of, many smaller transactions, and they comprise this giant picture. You have to look at what the aftershock is across the board. And Kenny, there is so much debt outstanding right now.
Understood. But what are you going to do? You're going to keep rates at near zero, and then you're going to ignite at some point. Inflation's going to rear its ugly head, and it's going to get – listen, do you remember – I don't know if you remember this, but when I graduated college in 1983, interest rates were 21%. Unemployment was 13%. Inflation was running at 10%, right? The economy was a disaster after the Jimmy Carter years. Ronald Reagan had just become president. That's when he instituted that massive tax reform act. And Paul Volcker was the one who ignited the bull market on Tuesday, August 17th, 1982, by cutting rates. 10%, which was 2 percentage points, was a massive move. And even though rates were still high at 19%, he drew the line in the sand that he was going to bring rates down, force money out of the banks, break the back of inflation, break the back of unemployment, and try to get this country going again, which he did, right? Because rates eventually came down to 4.5%, 5%, which were normalized.
Why is it so difficult for people to see that if you hold all the other dials and you gear rates, that hyperinflation is the inevitable result?
I have no idea. I have no idea why people don't seem to understand that or can't understand it. I have no idea. It's amazing to me that that we have this conversation. People look at you, oh no, they shouldn't raise rates. Dude, they have to raise rates.
Yeah, there's really no other option. I mean, unless what happens when rates go to zero, right? Let's say that the market pulls back here and the Fed feels like they need to step in and they need to do QE4. Yeah. And, the rates go back to zero, and then what? Then what's the only other option is to print?
Well, then where do you go? Well, you do like Europe did. Some parts of Europe and Asia, they had negative rates. That's how bad it got. They had negative rates. And so you certainly don't – you could go there, but you don't want to go negative rates. And so the Fed's in a very, very – interesting situation at the moment. I think that Jay Powell's doing the right thing. I think he tries to, encourage people, listen, understand it's going to be slow and gradual. He's not saying, look, we're raising rates at half a point at a time. We're going at a quarter basis point at a time. We're going to see how the market reacts. We're going to, not the market, but the overall economy reacts, right? And then we'll take it as we see it. But look, I think a week and a half ago when rates went from 3.1% to 3.27 over the period of a couple of days, investors forced the rates to go there, not the Fed. And that's when it happened so quickly. That move was so vicious and so fast. You saw what happened to the market. And Jay Powell came up right out and said, it's not what we're doing. We're not going that fast. We're about slow and steady.
And I know you say that the Fed is supposed to be an objective body, but you can't. So first off, it's obvious that Trump is going to say and do whatever he needs to say and do to try and create the appearance that the economy is robust under his presidency.
Correct.
Number one.
Correct.
You can't say that he doesn't at least in some small way have the ear of the Fed.
No, of course not. I'm sure he does. The same way Obama had the ear of the Fed every time he would make a comment. But listen, the Fed has to remain independent. If the Fed does this, look, a couple of weeks ago when Trump first came out and he started railing against Jay Powell, and there was all that concern about Jay Powell was going to announce they were going to not raise rates, or do this, he would have fallen victim to being pushed around by the president when he's supposed to be independent. The last thing Jay Powell could do or can do is, especially now after Trump has basically threatened him, the last thing Jay Powell can do is is stop the process. He has to continue with raising rates, because if he doesn't, he's going to be viewed as being a puppet.
Right,
and he can't be viewed as being a puppet.
That's what I was just talking to Bill Fleckenstein about on the previous podcast. You know, at that point, if he caves, which right. you're saying he can't, that becomes a big psychological tell, right? In the
right, but then nobody believes in the Fed anymore. The Fed's not an independent agency. They're gonna do what the president tells them to do. You know, he cannot. That's the last thing he can do. And so the more, in my opinion, the more Trump rails on Jay Powell, the more Jay Powell sticks his feet in the ground and says, sorry, rates are going up in December. Right. And then they're going up three more times in 2019.
Why do you think it took the Fed so long to begin with to start raising rates after, you know, the crisis?
Because I think two things. I think they were overly cautious. Considering the depth of the financial crisis that we went through, I think that they were. I think when it went from Bernanke to Yellen, I think Yellen could have started a little bit sooner. And I would criticize her. If you look at some of my notes, I would criticize the fact that she didn't. That she kept putting it off. I think she was overly cautious. And so now. I think Jay Powell is not necessarily being, I think he's being cautious, but I think he's trying to take it down the road where it should go, right? And it should have been started by Yellen. Whether or not you want to think the Democrats or Obama was putting pressure on Yellen not to do it, you know, that was one thing Obama never did. He never came out and openly criticized the Fed. Right. Whether or not he did it behind the scenes, I don't know. But, you know, Trump is openly criticizing the Fed and taking shots at the Fed chairman. I don't think that helps his case at all. I think that only forces Jay Powell to say, listen, dude, keep your mouth shut because rates are going up anyway. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and then you throw in the addition of the trade wars that are going on at the same time, and it takes the volatility right. of the rate hikes kind of to the nth degree. And you just know, again, going back to You don't want to create a crisis of confidence in the psychology of the presidential officer of the Fed. You know he can't back down from any of those negotiations that he has at this point.
No, but here's the point. I will say, if the trade talks between the U.S. and China continue to get dragged out and really start to create a problem for the not only for the U.S. economy, but for the global economy, then I could say that Jay Powell might have some cover to say, listen, this is getting drawn out longer than we suspected. We can start to see the global economy having a problem. We can start to see the U.S. economy is going to have a problem. So then I could see he's got a little bit of cover. But if we end up solving this trade China thing, which the trade tariffs with China, if we end up solving that, then Jay's got to continue down the road he's going down. But for him to stop raising rates because Donald Trump's yelling at him is the worst thing he could do. People lose confidence in the Fed. They'll call it a puppet Fed, and then that'll be the end of the Fed's ability to try to create, you know, manage the economy as in the way they're supposed to.
Well, listen, I wanted to get your take on something. I wasn't really an active trader or an active participant in the capital markets prior to the 2008 collapse. I was still learning though, and I didn't, you know, certainly didn't have the grasp on things that I do now, which is still a limited grasp. But one of my friends who is a trader and has a fair amount of experience commented to me a couple of days ago that the swings, the, you know, up 500, down 400,
yep.
down 600,
yep.
up 500, like we've been seeing here, just the volatility yeah. in general, even without direction here. You know, these last 2 days, we lost 600 on the Dow. We bid it back up 500 today or whatever. He said yeah. that's reminiscent of him to prior to the housing crisis. And I wanted to just, I mean, I know there's nobody trading really on the floor anymore, but I wanted to just get your feel. I mean, you've been in it for decades. What does it feel like to you? Does it feel like
that's... It doesn't feel like that to me at all. It doesn't feel like that to me at all. Because remember, here was the issue with what happened around the housing crisis. Remember, it wasn't the economy or stocks that caused the problem. It was all those very complex, very sexy mortgage products that helped people buy houses they couldn't afford, right? Which was actually started by Cisneros during the Clinton presidency, you know, when everyone had to, they were going to let everyone in America realize the American dream. Everyone's going to be able to buy a house. And so they came to Wall Street and they asked Wall Street to create products to allow the banks, to allow people to be able to buy houses. So that was really the genesis of how the housing market started to really, really take off. But then what happened was, when the economy just started to slow, it was just slowing, you know, just in the normal cycle. But then when all those people bought those houses and they had the adjustable rates and all of a sudden the rate jumped and the people couldn't afford it, and then they had to start to get out. Remember, all those products, those mortgage-backed products that investors around the world bought, all of a sudden those froze. Those investors couldn't sell those products. Right. There were no bids for those products. And so what did investors do when people get nervous? Holy fuck, I can't get out of this position. I got all this money tied up. I'm afraid I got to raise cash somewhere else. Right. What do? You hit the sell button in stocks, because guess what? It's a lit market. You can see the bid in GE. You can see the bid in Telephone. You can see the bid in Johnson & Johnson. And you hit the sell button and you sell stocks. And so stocks came under pressure because they couldn't sell all that other crap. Right? Which is the reason we had the meltdown around the world, because you couldn't sell that crap in the United States. There were no bids for it in Europe. There were no bids for it in Asia. In fact, all those investors, everyone was trying to sell all that crap and there were no bids, but there were bids in stocks. And so the world collapsed, right? The financial markets collapsed, not because there was anything wrong with stocks or really there was anything fundamentally so wrong with the economy. Now, the economy ended up crashing because when that happened, it created a complete disaster. But I think that exacerbated kind of the weakness in the economy. I don't think the economy was nearly as weak as the stock market kind of detailed. The stock market came under all that pressure because all that other crap was hanging over the market and nobody could sell it and they had all that money tied up in it.
Interesting. So what you're saying now is we'll probably see more of just a traditional deleveraging now versus one where there's all this illiquid, all this capital in illiquid markets that needs to...
Correct. Okay. I don't think that's the case. But look, the other thing about the swings, and most of your listeners, maybe they know this, maybe they don't. You know, so much of the market is so 21st century completely automated. Order delivery is automated. Order execution is automated. Order settlement and clearing and settlement is automated. And so therefore, there's less and less humans in the picture. So the problem is the algorithms that now execute and deliver the order flow and execute the order flow, they're written on a set of rules. The rules are very, very clear, but they are also sterile. There's no, you and I considering, oh my God, Johnson & Johnson's down 5 points. I mean, this is stupid. Stop selling it. But the computer, all it knows is, here's a set of rules I have to follow. I got to sell stock every 30 seconds, so I sell stock. It makes no difference where it goes. The rule says, you got to keep selling, got to keep selling, got to keep selling. So now you get this flush in the market. And then when you start to break technical trend lines, the 50, the 100, the 200, right, then there's a whole nother rule set that kicks in that says, okay, we broke the 50. Now we got to sell more stock to raise cash to protect the portfolio, which only creates more sell pressure, right? And then you break the 100 and all of a sudden now we got to sell more stock. And then when it broke the 200, notice what it did yesterday. It tested the 200 on the S&P 3 or 4 times. It broke it, it rallied back. It broke it, it rallied back. When it broke it the fourth time and the algos realized the buyers were not there,
right,
they fell out of bed,
right,
because the sell orders just inundated the system and the buyers just withdrew their bids, bid much lower, and the market went from, you know, 27.10, which was the low of last week. The minute it broke that, we traded right down to where we'd go, 26.55. We dropped 50 points in a very short period of time. And it's all because the speed at which the technology allows it to happen. Now, I think it's overdone. I wrote it in my note this morning. Don't be surprised. Watch, the market's going to close up today. Great. It closed up 400 points. Don't be surprised if you see the market down 200 tomorrow, because there's been so much internal damage to not only the indexes but to the individual stocks that until it finds some stability, and it's only going to find stability by thrashing around. So you're going to see now these moves – up moves, down moves, up moves, down moves, until it starts to settle in. I actually thought last week it was starting to settle in, but then we got all, you know, you get all ramped up again because you got some negative earnings surprises, which caused some angst in the tech space. And then, you know, they lit up again, right? The algos lit up again and sold the market off.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring that up too, because I for my patrons, the people that support the podcast, I put out a little comment to them the other day, just letting them know that, you know, you were going to come on the podcast, and if they had any questions, to shoot them over to me, and I would try to ask them to you. And this kind of dovetails nicely into it, because most of the questions that I got from people that have listened to you in the past were about algorithmic trading. They were about high frequency trading. So I'm going to ask you just two of them here, and maybe you can. I'm going to try and kind of group them together so I don't have to ask all of them. But generally, like, one person asks, has the automation of trading stocks helped the momentum of trading? And somebody else has asked, you know, I would ask Kenny what risks he sees with the majority of trades being facilitated by bots and using high frequency trading techniques. Do you think this makes technical analysis more self-fulfilling? Or a leading indicator versus a lagging one, you know, charting and all this shit kind of becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, right?
Right. So go to the first one, right? So the first question you asked, it was, repeat the first question.
The first question was, has the automation of trading of stocks helped lead to momentum trading?
Yes.
This is from brother Ethan Watkins.
So it is absolutely exacerbated the momentum move, only because it can happen faster, right? So when stocks are under accumulation, it just happens faster. And so you get the momentum players, I call them the Momo players, you know, they jump right on board because the speed at which it can happen in either direction. So the momentum trade works both getting out and getting in, right? And because the technology is so efficient, because the market is now so fractured, and there are 11 exchanges plus 40 or 50 different alternative venues where you can buy and sell stock, those algorithms and that technology has to be able to spray those markets. And so, yes, it exacerbates the move for a momentum trader. Absolutely. In either direction. The next question about, you know, how does the technology affect technical analysis and all that. Here's the deal. Technical analysis on its own, in my opinion, is still a very core principle. I love to look at stocks on a technical basis. But here's the problem, and I just said it. The algorithms are written with a rule set. The algorithms, they can't, you and I could sit there and be a little bit emotional about it. We can give ourselves a little bit more room. We can kind of on the fly decide, well, you know, I'm going to wait. I'm going to give it a little bit more time to see how it works. The minute in an algorithm, the minute that the stock or the market breaks a certain level, all the algorithm knows is, okay, we broke that level. That means I got to sell X percent. It doesn't mean, oh, wait, let me just stop it. Maybe it doesn't feel like it's going to break apart right away, but it creates the break, which is where I went yesterday. When we broke 2710 after we tested it four times, which was last week's lows, that was well below the 200-day, but it was the low set last week. The market's been trying to find some stability around 2710. When we tested it three times yesterday, on the fourth time when it didn't hold, it fell right out of bed because the rule set in the algorithm said you need to make sales. And look, the market fell out of bed. The S&P went from 2710 to 2655 very quickly. And so the technology, the algorithm, the logic is such that there's no room for it to consider. Right. You and I can consider. Yeah. OK. We're saying it's testing. It's breaking. But we're not going to panic yet. When it tests, it breaks. All their algorithm knows is, OK, it broke. I got to do this now. Right.
That's right. Yeah, exactly.
And so yesterday when it tested and broke three times, right, it tested when it started to trade down, the algorithm realized the buyers were still there. But when it tested it the fourth time and all of a sudden it was searching for the buyers and it didn't and there were no buyers there, that's when it said, OK, bingo, time to let go. And boom, it let go. Right. And so the speed at which it can happen exacerbates the move. And that, again, today, the market's up 400. Why? Has the story really changed? Not at all.
Right.
But yet it was so oversold. The risk management algorithms that now look at the data after last night's debacle, they wake up this morning and go, oh, wow, these stocks are cheap now. They're way oversold. And boom, from the minute the market opened, the market was up today. The minute it opened, right, it opened stronger and stayed stronger and closed right into the bell.
Yeah, even with the overnight session overseas, you know, being red
as a result. Yeah, was mixed.
Right.
That's exactly. Right, was mixed.
Right.
And
right.
I actually thought because Europe had opened weaker, then it had rallied, then it got weaker again, but yet we opened strong and we stayed strong. But the question is, was it really strong or was it really a lot of bargain hunting? Look, the other thing that people should pay attention to is the amount of volume, right? If you see volume really exploding in either direction, then you know there's much more of a commitment. If the volume is relatively stable, then you know, a lot of that's just the algorithm stuff going, right? But if all of a sudden the volume explodes to the downside, then you know there's really a change in market psyche. There's a change in investor psyche.
So I know you were on the horn right before you came on the podcast with me. Did you get a chance to look at Amazon's numbers, Google's numbers?
No, I only looked at them briefly. They were coming out while I was on the horn, so I couldn't do anything about it then. But I saw that the numbers, the earnings numbers all beat, but a couple of them missed on the revenue line, right? Didn't Google miss?
Yeah, Amazon, they both had revenue misses. They both had EPS beats. And then the guide, I didn't see Google's guide, but Amazon's guide was not up to snuff, I think.
Right.
At all.
And so both those stocks are down in the aftermarket session.
Yeah, and actually the SPY is down almost 1% now here aftermarket. Right. Also. So, it's almost given back what it gained today.
So there you go. Exactly what I said, right? Look how fast you're going to lose it tomorrow. Don't be surprised.
Dude, one thing.
Right? It's down.
Go ahead.
1% is down 27 points on the S&P.
Yeah, like 25, yeah. 24 points. Yep,
right.
Exactly.
Yep.
Yeah, so one thing I will never accuse you of, Kenny, is wasting a breath. I will tell you that. Every time I listen to you, by the end of your sentence, I feel like you were just hanging on to the... You get to this point like this, or you just finish... You barely have enough breath to finish your sentence, and you take these huge, big, colossal deep breaths, and then start over again, man. I love it. I love it. So, look, looking forward, what are you going to be looking at, man? What do you... Like... Tomorrow, I assume you're going to be going to the floor tomorrow morning. What's the first thing you're going to look at tomorrow morning when you show up?
So listen, we're still in the throes of earnings seasons, right? We got another couple of days of earnings, and then we're going to be through it. And then you got to start paying attention to certainly the midterms. They're only 2 weeks away, right?
Because exactly.
There's going to be a lot of this volatility is also kind of around the uncertainty about what's going to happen. Are the Democrats going to take control of the House? Are they going to take control of the Senate? I don't think that's going to happen. I think they'll get the House. I don't think they're going to get the Senate. And so then we're going to end up with gridlock for the next 2 years,
right?
Which actually, gridlock is not necessarily bad for the market.
Right.
The market doesn't mind when there's gridlock. But if we go, if the whole place flips to Democrats, then it's going to be another problem because then they'll be in complete control. They'll start to pull back on all the pro-growth policies that this current Congress has put in place. They'll start that you can immediately know they're going to start impeachment proceedings against the president, and so it'll be a lot of noise, right? I don't ultimately think that's going to happen because I think they're only going to get control of the House,
right?
And if they do, that'll end up being gridlock. Gridlock for the next 2 years is not bad. I'm not sure what it means for Trump in 2020, but it certainly wouldn't be bad for the market.
Yeah, you might even argue it would be the best case scenario for the market.
Right.
Like, hey, just don't fucking touch anything. You know, nobody move.
Right. Right. No, I agree. And so, therefore, over the next, you know, the next couple of days or couple of weeks, I'm going to certainly pay attention to the end of earnings season because you have to. Tomorrow morning, I'm going to be looking at how the markets reacted to Amazon and Google and Alphabet overnight, and then what they're looking forward to for Facebook is next week, and or Intel, Google, and Amazon today, right?
Yeah,
and next week
it's Intel Facebook had a good report today.
Right, so, Intel had a good report, yeah. And that was actually up in the after-hours session.
Yeah.
But next week it'll be Facebook, and it'll be whoever else is coming out next week.
Is that probably – my next question was going to be, you know, who do you really have your eye on for next week? And, you know, what do you think is going to have the biggest impact on the broader market in terms of earnings next week? And I'm guessing Facebook is it because it's the only one you've mentioned.
Well, listen, I think certainly Facebook is going to have – I'm not a big buyer of Facebook at all. I don't use it. I'm not a fan of Facebook. I certainly think the Facebook numbers will drive action in technology. I don't believe that Facebook's numbers, whether they're good or bad, are going to drive the action in the broader market. I'm just because I'm not a Facebook supporter. I think Facebook is. I'm just not a Facebook
just
supporter.
Say it. Just
right?
Fucking say it, Kenny. So, come on. You spent all day on CNBC biting your tongue. Just say it, will you?
But I think Facebook will affect certainly what goes on in technology. I'm not looking for Facebook at all to talk about what's happening in the broader market at all. I think you have to look for other earnings reports. And I don't have the list right in front of me next week. But we got energy. What do we have next week? Energy names?
You're asking the wrong person.
Yeah, I thought you had the list right. I thought you had the list right in front of you.
What?
Yeah, no, I don't have the list in front of me.
I got a couple of empty beer bottles in front of me. That's about it.
You know, I'll look tomorrow morning and see what's on the docket for next week. But really, it is the end of – next week is the end of the earnings season, and then you're going to really have to start to pay attention to the midterms because that's really going to start to rear its head. I mean, it already is, but in the next 2 weeks, it's really going to rear its head as both sides try to get people to come out and vote and support them to see where it goes. Look, I think if the Republicans keep control, I think the market just blasts higher. If the Republicans keep control, if they lose one house, if they lose the house to the Democrats, then I think you see the market kind of churn. Right. And if we lose both houses, I think you see the first reaction. The first reaction is going to be the market back off.
Well, I think
if we lose both houses,
if I had to guess in that situation where it goes full on Democrat. I think you would see, I mean, just think about the last year or 2 years and what this administration has done to rally the market, even just the tax cuts. Let's just talk about tax cuts. Forget about the rest of the deregulation that they're trying to push through. And I think the thought of Democrats being in charge at a time where rates are, you know, on the rise and the market looks kind of skittish to begin with, I think could send us down 1,000 points in a day on the Dow.
Easily. I would easily agree with you. But now let's not be a panic here, right? I don't think that's going to happen because I think the Republicans will maintain the Senate. I think there's a real risk that they lose the House, but I think the market already expects that they're going to lose the House.
Right. Yeah, I think so too.
So some of that is built in. So in fact, if they lose the House, that's why I think the market might just churn. If they lose the House, the market will just churn and keep the Senate. Right, I think if they maintain both chambers, then I think the market takes off.
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense. That makes perfect sense. So, all right, listen, Kenny, I don't want to hold you too long. I'm really stoked that you came back on. My last question to you, actually, I'm going to ask you two more questions. You got a minute?
Yep.
All right. Well, you said that kind of unconvincingly. Are you sure you have a minute?
No, I do.
I know you have a life and stuff, so you just cut me off whenever. I don't have much of a life, so I have a tendency to be very long-winded. Just tell me you got to go if you got to go. I'm going to ask you a question that I asked the Nigerian brothers in Vegas, and they didn't give me an answer because they were trying to be nice. And I asked Bill Fleckenstein also on the last podcast. He didn't really give me an answer either. So if you come out and you hang your balls out there and you give me an answer here, I'm gonna be very much impressed. And this is not a poisonous, toxic question. This is a legitimate question. It's just one that, you know, people, I guess, just don't want to answer for some reason. I mean, I would speak about it very frankly. But the question is, look, Kenny, you've been around the markets for 3 decades. All right. You have extensive experience. You read the financial news every single day. I want to know, when you go and you look at a headline, you see something cross the wire and it's breaking news, whether it's a macro story, whether it's a political story, whether it's a company specific story, but if it's a scoop or it's an exclusive, I want to know what reporters would put their name on that article where you're going to say immediately, I'm 95% sure that this scoop is good and this exclusive is good. And I want to know what reporters you would see with their name on it. It would make you say, well, let's wait to see if somebody follows up on it. Let's wait for more confirmation, or I want to double check.
You know, that's a very interesting question.
That's why nobody wants to fucking answer it.
No, but as you're asking it, in my mind, I'm trying to run through if I even pay attention to reporters' names. Like yesterday, here's a perfect example. Yesterday in the Wall Street Journal, the guy who wrote the article I put it in my note because the way he wrote it, I'm like, dude, really? His name is Akani Otendi or something. He's in the Wall Street Journal. So he writes the article about what happened in the market yesterday. And his comment about oil got absolutely smashed on Wednesday, right? It was down 4%. And his commentary was, oil is down 4% because people are fearful that the Saudis are gonna ramp up production. And I thought to myself, fearful? fearful? Are you kidding me? They're not fearful. The Saudis are ramping up production because now they got to play nice in the sandbox after killing this guy. So, dude, I called them right out. Are you kidding me? They're not fearful. It's exactly what's happening. And it's happening because the Saudis have to increase production because right now they're in between a rock and a hard place. They've got blood all over their hands, and now they're trying to get out of it. The last thing they want to do is see oil go to $100 a barrel because then it'll really be a problem. And so, like, I called him right out in my note yesterday just because as I read it, I go, dude, you completely missed this one, right? But now when you ask me that question, I think of other reporters. I don't – when I read a headline – Unless it's something that grabs me in such a way, I don't really look at the reporters' names. I don't. So I can't tell you a handful of reporters that I even know.
All right, but what about sources? What about sources in general? Then what about actual financial media sources as a whole, as opposed to naming reporters?
Well, you mean like the Wall Street Journal or CNN, like that kind of
source? Yeah, I want to know who has the most gravitas with you. Listen, man, you've been around the markets for 3 decades, right?
So
you've got this intangible that other people don't have, which is ingrained in you. You've been through some shit, and I want to know where you stand.
So I think Investor's Business Daily is a great source. I think they're unbiased. I think that they're very direct in their reporting. And I think if you look at any of the headlines, because they're not sensationalist, right? They're not trying to put sensational headlines. The Journal will sometimes put a sensational headline, but I think IBD is if you're looking for kind of honest, and you're looking for. I shouldn't say honest. Honest is
objective,
maybe the wrong
word. Objective.
Objective.
Right.
If you're looking for objective, I think the IBD is great. I think the IBD is great. For the most part, I also like a lot of what I read on Bloomberg, right? I love the way they report on Bloomberg.
Sure.
I think their presentation and their analysis is actually fairly decent. A lot. Certainly, there are plenty of people on CNBC that I follow that I think do a great job in their reporting. I don't think necessarily that they're sensationalist. I think that they, for the most part, their analysis is short and sweet. It's not necessarily so in depth, and so that's why I prefer if I look at IBD or if I look at Bloomberg. I think those stories tend to have more meat to them.
Who's your favorite person on CNBC to talk to?
Oh, dude, I think there's a bunch of people. I love to talk to Tyler Matheson, Bill Griffith, Sue Herrera, Wilfred Frost. I love to talk to Melissa Lee does a great job. I don't talk to her nearly as much as I would like to. Scott Wapner on Halftime Report, I wish I had more exposure to him. I never talk to the guys in the morning because I'm not on those morning shows.
Right.
The only one occasionally is Carl Quintanilla, who I think does an outstanding job.
I like
but
Carl
I don't have enough
a
exposure.
Lot.
Yeah, I love Carl. I don't have enough exposure to the morning guys because I'm not on those morning shows. But in the afternoon, all those names I just gave you, Kelly did a great job. She's out on maternity leave, but she'll be back. She's easy to talk to. She understands. I think she's got a great way about the way she presents and asks questions. And so I always find them very engaging.
I met Tyler Matheson in Vegas 2 weeks ago. I was there for the Traders for a Cause conference. And I got to tell you, man, I have to tell you, having no opinion on him going into it at all, because I rarely, you know, he just does kind of this dry stuff once in a while. So I don't really pay too much attention to him. But I have to tell you, what a nice person.
He is a sweetheart, humble person.
Yep. He's just a really gentle person and a very nice guy.
He's a sweetheart.
I got a great impression from him. I really did. There was one. Going back to Carl, one of the reasons that I like Carl Quintanilla, I figured out, is because I feel like when I watch my financial news media, I want to get as objective as possible, like you're saying.
Right.
The same reason
Carl's very
IBD. Yeah, and Carl is like, you know, to be a journalist, there should not be, you know, if you're going to go out and you're going to be fucking Kanye West, like, you want to be sensationalist and you want, you know, you don't want to get to a point where people are saying, like, this guy kind of needs more salt or needs more pepper or whatever. But when you're reporting on financial news, I think that the closer you get to that, the better. And I always felt like Carl has had a very even keel and he just reports and he's professional and he just does his job. He's clinical.
Yeah. Carl doesn't get – the only thing I love about Carl is his tone never changes from one story to the next. So you can't, you know, he may have an opinion one or the other, but he's very good at being objective. And he's a sweet, he's another sweetheart. And he's well balanced. He's knowledgeable. He certainly understands. He's easy to talk to. I think he's great.
I've seen him box too, Kenny. He can throw him.
Yeah, I'm sure he can. You know, when I used to see Carl on TV when he was on the early show before he came to the floor, I always thought that he was about 5'2".
Right.
Right? He's 6'1".
Oh, he's a big boy.
He's a tall man. And so when he first came to the floor, I went, wait, who are you? I had this impression of him that he was like 5'2 or 5'3. Right. I don't know why I had that impression. But when I first met him and he came to the floor, he's taller than I am. I'm like, whoa, dude, where'd you come from? He's such a great guy. I wish I had more exposure to Carl, but he's on in the morning, typically when the market's just getting started.
Right.
So
there's
not necessarily a time for them to talk about.
Usually flanked by Kramer and Faber, right?
Kramer and Faber. And Arthur Cashin has a regular spot on his show. When Arthur's away or if Arthur's on vacation, he'll get me occasionally to sit in. And I love when I do that because I just enjoy him a lot.
Yeah, awesome. Well, all right. My last question to you before I let you go, having used up almost an hour of your time already, is heading into the holiday season, so we are almost at the end of October here. We're going to be heading into November. The holiday season is, of course, a time for food and beverage. And for those that do not subscribe to your morning newsletter, they do not know that you somehow come up with a recipe every day to send out. And I know that you're not just copying and pasting it from somewhere. Because I can tell you fucking type it in because shit's misspelled and uppercase letters are lowercase and stuff. So I'm like, Kenny is writing a fucking recipe every single morning on top of pages of market commentary. So my question is, what's the meal for November? What's the drink for November at the Bulcari household before I let you go?
So is November, you're talking about Thanksgiving specifically?
I mean, just generally, what's going on at the Bulcari household right now?
So, you know, I will start to give you, and I already started to give you as we move into kind of the holiday season, Thanksgiving. I'm starting to give you dishes around Thanksgiving, you know, the pumpkin risotto or the pumpkin and sweet sausage pasta rigatoni or the butternut squash risotto or the butternut squash pie, whatever, right? I'm starting to give you kind of holiday things that we'll make, things that we'll do. Certainly at Thanksgiving, listen, I'm Italian, right? So I come from an Italian household for Thanksgiving. So you got to start
Italian.
With the Italian wedding soup. And then you got to start with then you got to have the pasta. Then you got to have all the vegetables and turkey. By the time you get to the vegetables and turkey, you're not even hungry anymore after you've had the pasta and the soup, right? And I start to give you all those recipes, right? Because I do repeat those recipes around the holidays because they're it's part of who I am. It gives people a sense of what's going on in my house. And the best one I love, and it starts in December, is when I give you the you know, for Christmas Eve we do the seven fishes because that's what Italians do.
Okay, yep.
And on Christmas Eve, and so I give you every year, I give you the seven fishes. Each day I'll give you a different fish recipe that I make in my house on Christmas Eve. And it's such a tradition in my house. You know, I grew up with it ever since I was a kid. It's just what we did. And I think it's the greatest night of the year, but I give you all those recipes. So I give you a sense of you know, who I am, certainly around the holidays with the food that I cook.
And what are you drinking?
Listen, I love a martini, but, you know, we'll drink certainly around
gin
the holidays.
Gin or vodka?
We'll drink eggnog. No, vodka. No, vodka martini, not a gin martini. I can't drink gin. I had a bad experience with gin when I was a young man, and I can't go back. So I drink vodka. And, yeah, I'm really a vodka drinker, and I'm a wine drinker. More white wine than red because red gives me agita if I drink too much of it. But, yeah,
tell me your vodka martini preference. You know, I was a bartender for a very long time,
so we can go as deep as
you want on this, Kenny.
I'll go into Capital Grill, who makes an outstanding this bar maid, her name is Heidi at the Capital Grill down in Wall Street. I'll go in there, and so I'll order a Tito's martini, shaken, not stirred, served on the rocks, a little bit dirty with three blue cheese stuffed olives.
Oh man, that sounds fantastic. That's one way to do it, man.
And I've actually featured that as one of my recipes. You know, the vodka martini. I said one of the days when the market was going crazy, I'm like, look, just have a martini, and I give them my martini recipe. But think it's a great drink. It's easy to drink. It's on the rocks. And so therefore, as the ice melts, it kind of waters it down a little bit, so you're not completely smashed. And there you go.
Awesome. Well, listen, Kenny, I just want to tell you one thing, brother, which is that when we did our first podcast together, I think this is our third now, but when we did our first, the spoos are off 32 handles now, just so you know. But
they're off 32. They're 30, off?
32 right now, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's what the SPY is doing. I mean, the Globex isn't open yet, but.
Right.
So anyways, listen, man, when you came on and did our first podcast, you had, you know, 3 decades of experience. You're an extremely well-known market commentator. Like you said to me today, you just got off the horn with Australia before you came on the podcast. And I have to tell you, man, you hung your neck out there a little bit to come on a podcast with somebody that you've never met before. Although we did meet that one time we hung out at the floor, and I think this was after that. So maybe knew I wasn't a complete psychopath. But having said that, you know, you risked far more by coming on than I did, because you have built a career and a reputation over 3 years. And I just wanted to sincerely thank you for doing that. And as I'm listening to you talk on this podcast, I'm just thinking about how thankful I am that you took that chance and that you continue to come back. And I hope this is the beginning of a great friendship, man, where we can continue to talk about the markets for a long time.
Well, listen, you do the right thing, right? We're talking about the markets. We're not talking about stuff we shouldn't be talking about. And so, therefore, as far as I'm concerned, I think it's educational for the listeners. I think I've got a wealth of knowledge that I'm happy to share with people that may not ever have the opportunity to either come to the floor to see the New York Stock Exchange, but yet they hear it through my, you know, 3 decades worth of experience.
Yeah, exactly. And I just think it's such a great benefit to people that are listening. And, you know, personally, like I said, I had never met you in person. You welcomed me onto the NYSE floor. I'm actually looking. I got my little NYSE tag here hanging up on the wall. That was August 14th, 2017. And I just looked you up out of nowhere and said, hey, I'm trying to come to the New York Stock Exchange. I'm in New York. And you were like, yeah, fuck it, whatever. Come on, no problem. You know, you gave me the whole kit and caboodle, the speech, and introduced me to people and everything. And, you know, without even knowing me. And I really appreciate that. I want you to know that.
Listen, here's the deal. I think the New York Stock Exchange is an American icon, and I think it's part of the national fabric. And I think as an American, people should understand it. They should fall in love with the place. They should be able to see it. But after the events of 9/11, they stole that from us, because you just can't come to the New York Stock Exchange any longer.
Right.
It's too valuable. You can't risk it. And so there's a part of me that's sad about that, right? Because I think every American should have the ability to see it and feel it and understand it and get to know it. And I've had the privilege of being able to work there for 38 years. As a member of the institution, I bleed the blood of the institution. I think it's the greatest place in the world. So it was my pleasure, and I'm glad that you had the opportunity.
Well, and as such, Mr. Polcari, you're turning into somewhat of an icon yourself, my friend. So that's honest to God, man. Honest to God.
I don't know.
You
say, good or bad?
If you hang around, if you hang around something long enough, you start to become one with it, right? And that's how it is.
Yeah.
I'll let you slide, but I really appreciate you coming on, Kenny, and I hope we get to talk again soon, brother.
All right, bye-bye.
All right, take care. That was the one, the only, Kenny Polcari. Kind gentleman, kind enough to take a chance on coming on the QTR podcast, and it's good to hear him on here, you know, talking a little bit of shit, you know, using his lexicon that I know he uses outside of probably the CNBC studios, but I do. That was some serious shit, man. I really give him a lot of credit for doing it, and I appreciate him very much. So, all right, that is it for today. I got a bunch of stuff lined up. I know I always say that, and it doesn't change, you know, the pace with which I do podcasts. But real quick before I split, I do want to very much again thank my Patreons, guys like Ethan Watkins, who submitted a question for this one, Eckhart Richter, Mark Rulo, Lars Hoffman, Chris Beat again, Charlie Rimkus. You know, you guys are fantastic, and you guys are the engine that kind of keeps this podcast running, or at least is showing me that there's enough positive feedback to keep pushing forward with it. And I genuinely want to thank you guys for that. I really appreciate it. And if you're not a patron, there's no minimum to become a patron. And I do try to post up now little spots where patrons can submit questions for guests that I'm going to have on. So you're more than welcome to check it out. And the patron link is all over the place, my Twitter and everywhere else. So I got a million people asking me about Tesla. I'm going to talk about that at some other point. I still have to go over my Traders for a Cause visit. I touched on it there with Kenny a little bit. I spoke to Tyler Madison, who I thought was a great guy. But I want to run all that shit back for you, too. So maybe I'll do it this weekend. I'll do a solo John by myself. But as for right now, one more time, I really appreciate you guys. And I am the fuck out of here. Peace.